Welcome to Inside Infrastructure. We're joined today by Peter Regan, who's the CEO of Sydney Metro. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
So we did some research for this podcast and we found out, we've known each other for a long time, but I found out you're a Novocastrian.
That is correct.
Explain yourself.
Well, I was born there. I didn't decide that, but I did grow up in Newcastle and I still love Newcastle. A beautiful place to grow up, beaches, outdoors, very relaxed. But I did leave Newcastle for Sydney once I finished school to come to university. Yeah. And I haven't lived back there since, but I do like visiting.
And your dad was a town planner?
That's correct, yeah.
And so there's like a genetic thing in city making?
Yeah, I think there's some infrastructure, city shaping genes that pass down. My dad also worked in public transport as well.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess I probably grew up being a little bit surrounded by some of the thinking around good planning and good transport, but I hadn't set out to work in transport myself.
So what did you want to do when you were a kid?
Well, I started as a fireman like most people and and then moved on to being the Prime Minister. And I was going to be a lawyer.
Still time for
people. Yeah, well, you never know.
I think fireman might be out though.
Yeah. It's probably not my area. Yeah. But I went through university. I did commerce, accounting, finance. And, you know, I suspected I would sort of continue down that sort of financing path. But, you know, as things turn out, financing became financing of infrastructure. And then I sort of got into building infrastructure and transport infrastructure more specifically, and it sort of moved up down that path, but it wasn't a deliberate choice, no.
So when you got the financing of infrastructure, so you went and worked for a bank?
Yeah, so I worked at Pricewaterhouse for a while, before it was PricewaterhouseCoopers, sort of corporate finance, corporate advisory stuff.
And they were just the deals coming through?
Yeah, and it was interesting, you know, I learned financial modelling, and so I became quite a gun sort of Excel guru for a while there. I've forgotten most of it now. But that led me into sort of the modelling and then project financing, and then I went to Deutsche Bank.
Yeah. Sorry, I just wanted to deep dive in the Excel. Were you one of those people that could drive Excel without the mouse?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Can you do that, Janet? Can you drive Excel without a mouse?
I'm not deep on Excel, but yes. I can work within Excel.
I think it was one of those right place, right time things though, because, and you would have to be a bit of a modelling nerd to know this, but there was a sort of a quantum leap change in the capability of spreadsheet software with Excel 97, which was a very particular upgrade that it suddenly allowed you to do graphics and to make it look really good instead of looking just like, you know, reams of numbers.
Yeah.
And I happened to be there right when that sort of came on. And so suddenly people thought, oh, look at these models. Yeah. They must be accurate because they look so good.
Yeah. And it's the people that can do the formatting without the mouse. Yeah. They're the ones that really scare me.
Yeah, look, I was pretty into it at the time. I did do Visual Basic coding in Excel as well, but I can tell you I cannot remember any.
So there were a bunch of project finance deals, transactions that came through that world. You were put on the modelling.
That's right. So the main one I did when I was still at Pricewaterhouse, which was sort of mid to late 90s, and everyone who's worked in infrastructure has had a turn, but I did do a lot of work on the high speed, what was called the very high-speed train proposal at the time between Sydney and Canberra, modelled all of that. And I think at the time it was going to cost $3 billion and it was regarded as not affordable. in hindsight, I think what I've learned is probably it was going to cost more than that.
Yeah.
But still, it might have been better to do it then than now.
That would have been a good deal, I think.
And you'd have done a high-speed rail business case at some stage?
My team had done, yes, and I've done some work benchmarking actual faster rail versus high-speed rail outcomes in terms of population and economic growth on different corridors.
Yeah. And I was on an advisory panel for the 2012 high-speed rail stage 2 study, which was the production of a business case, and it was $114 billion in 2010 dollars or something then, and it was,
I think everyone's had a go.
Then.
Everyone has. Yeah. It has gone around and around, hasn't it?
It has. And look, it would be amazing, but they are very, very big commitments. And I think building that linear infrastructure, be it railways, roads, electricity.
The latest live proposal is Sydney Newcastle. So, I mean, that, maybe after Sydney Metro, that could be.
Well, as I said, I do like going to Newcastle.
You could go there very quickly.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you catch the train to Newcastle?
Sometimes.
Yeah, I have too.
Yeah. I did a lot when I was at university all the time, back and forward. But I think, yeah, the changes though in Newcastle, and certainly, you know, I was involved in the light rail up there for a while, and yeah, it is quite amazing to see
that kind of
infrastructure investment can really change somewhere. So it's pretty spectacular.
I do, like, in the last couple of times I've been to Newcastle, just even the food culture there has changed as a result of it.
It's very different. Yeah, some really nice restaurants there, actually.
Quite nice.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you decide to move to London?
So I'd been living in Sydney University, worked at Pricewaterhouse, worked at Deutsche Bank for a few years, and it was early kind of, you know, it was in around 2000, and Deutsche at the time, yeah, were offering opportunities to move some people around, and there was discussion about me going to New York or to London, and I was a lot more interested to go to London, and was really lucky that came off, and did a sort of a job swap with a guy at Deutsche in London, and went over there. And that's really when I got into sort of a lot of this transport sort of financing and stuff, because I thought it was really exciting, but they'd all been working over there for years on this massive transaction. And I thought, this is great. I'll get into this. And it turns out that no one else wanted to work on it because no one thought it was going to happen. It'd been going for years. And it was at the time, the biggest public-private partnership deal that had been done worldwide to upgrade the London Underground. And
is this under the Blair government?
It was, yeah, it was. And it was massively big and complicated. As it turned out, too big, too complicated, and the wrong kind of structure ended up being put together. But it did get done, and it injected an enormous amount of money into the upgrade of the underground. But that's when I first learnt about, you know, PPPs and concession agreements and all that sort of thing. And yeah, I was somewhat thrown in the deep end working on something that big, but it got me really interested in transport financing and the infrastructure sort of side of that. As opposed to just sort of, yeah, not so much the operation of transport, but how you can finance and pay for it.
That time at Deutsche in Sydney, there's a whole group of people that were at Deutsche at that time that have subsequently gone on to be the people we now see leading big parts of the set. So Kerry Schott was there, Scott Charlton was there, you were there, Alex Vendler. So what was it about that group at that time that have seemed to have emerged as sort of preeminence?
Look, it is really interesting because there's a lot of people, the team, you know, I worked for Scott Charlton, and there was, we probably had a team of about, there were 20, 25 of us. And yes, a lot of those people are still in infrastructure here in Australia or around the world. It was one of those kind of, you know, right place, right time things. There were lots of deals happening. There was privatization deals, the electricity sector. There was some other big infrastructure deals, and the market was really changing. There was really only the three really big players at the time in that part of project financing and banking. There was Macquarie, there was Deutsche, and there was Bankers Trust. And then Macquarie managed to get itself a job advising Deutsche on buying Bankers Trust. And so you ended up, you know, there were only two big players in the market. And then sort of the UBS team was growing as well, ABN AMRO, but it was pretty concentrated. And I think that group of people, we worked really hard. But we had a really sort of fun time doing it. And a lot of us have stayed either friends or have continued to sort of work with each other. I don't know why one particular group, you know, necessarily sort of creates so many people who've gone on to different roles, but, you know, I guess they recruited well and it was a good environment. People learned well. And if you ask Scott Charlton, I'm sure he'll tell you it's all to do with his training of all those people. But certainly he was a great guy to work and learn with. So
you were actually in the same team together.
Yes. Yeah, I worked for Scott.
Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, it's been interesting to see all those people sort of, you know, grow into different roles.
Well, you've been – you would have been at various times on the other side of the table from those people in subsequent –
Oh, look, absolutely. It's – yeah, Australia's a big market, but it's not that big. And certainly I have had a bit of a tendency through my career to work on the same kind of the same transaction from multiple sides. Both in London, you know, I put some deals together with the Underground, and then when I actually went to Transport for London, I ended up undoing those deals. Yeah, I think more positively, some of the stuff here in New South Wales, you know, with the WestConnex, you know, project, I worked on that sort of at Treasury. I worked on that at Sydney Motorway Corp and at Transport. So you see it from different angles, and but you do see that some of the same people keep popping up as well, either in the same companies or in different roles as they move around.
Can I ask about that? I think that's a really interesting part of your CV, that you sort of created something on one side in London and then went back to Transport for London to help undo part, or at least fix some of it. And you've been a bit of a fixer. And one of the things I saw you had recommended to people was that they should switch sides through their career.
Yeah.
And but when you see the same deal from a different angle, what do you learn about it that way? And what does that mean you've then been able to take into the deals you've done in New South Wales?
I think one of the really interesting things is when you look at a deal a second time that you were involved in putting together, you have to be really careful that you actually look at what the deal really says and what the contracts really say, not what you think it said when you did it. And I found that a lot of the time people who have been involved and they get involved again will say, no, it meant this. And then someone else looks at it and they say, well, no, actually, that's not what it says. Mm. So there's a real learning there, and make sure that you don't take over too much knowledge. But for me, it was actually that big deal in London on London Underground that it really became something that changed my career, because I realised that it was driven by a sort of a philosophical desire to bring the private sector in. But the asset itself and the way the deal was structured couldn't really transfer any meaningful risk, but there was almost a political philosophy to drive it through. And the deal was really well structured for the bankers and for the lawyers, but it didn't work for ultimately the taxpayer because that risk ended up still sitting with them. And it got me very interested in, well, how can you use the skills from investment banking and that the private sector would use in a government context, in a public sector context, to do better deals. And that's why I went to Transport for London in the first place. Like a lot of people, you know, Australians in London, I thought I was there for a couple of years. I ended up staying in London for 10 years. But really being able to find those opportunities where government, you know, is prepared to act commercially and to drive outcomes, but work creatively with the private sector to put things together that might not otherwise have happened. It's been a real highlight for me right through my career.
And when you're doing that, like, to what extent is it bespoke, and to what extent are you looking for a gold standard kind of, you know, value on both sides type? You know, what's the aim of what you're working towards in the?
Ultimately, in my experience, I think nearly all the transactions I've done have been pretty bespoke. You do sometimes get, more cookie cutter things where you can roll the same thing out, but that's hasn't really tended to be the areas I've been working in, mainly because of either the size or the complexity, or there's a particular circumstance that's needing to be sorted out. And I've kind of oscillated a little bit between doing deals and then restructuring deals. I think you probably learn a lot more restructuring deals, and especially deals that you didn't do yourself. It's probably where I've learned the most.
I'm going to come back to the bespoke transaction stuff later. Before I do, how often did you find yourself at Transport for London castigating your former self for decisions made?
Oh, well, of course, you forget quickly that you did that.
It's easier to correct the ones that someone else did.
That's right. You've got to live and learn, right? And I think but the way we were able to keep innovating the types of deal structures we were using, they got better. And certainly an opportunity to learn from things that didn't work out so well. I mean, some of the things I did at London in banking worked, some of them didn't. But certainly the experience at Transport for London was pretty amazing. It was at a time when it was an incredibly powerful organisation. Again, really, really good people, but well-funded, lead up to the Olympics. And so, there's lots of infrastructure that needed to get built. And they had, strong political will, strong support. They certainly weren't doing cookie cutter. It was very, very different in approach. And they became a real sort of leader in that space. It's a pity when you see now some of the challenges that they've had in being able to sort of not keep that model going. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, like, when you look at the age of the infrastructure somewhere like London, some of the other European cities, that they have been able to convert it to run such modern technologies and to carry so many people and to generate money out of railways that can pay for the whole transport system. It's truly phenomenal.
Some of that legacy of how many people it can transport, that is a legacy of the time at which it was built, and it was so extensive
Exactly, and it's you've got such great coverage
yeah.
That it is, you know, such a genuine option that you don't need a car to get around day to day. But I think, you know, we shouldn't be sort of sucked into sort of, you know, having a lack of ambition. You know, yes, Australian cities are big and they're spread out, but I think with really good infrastructure, you can sort of close down those gaps. You know, we'll probably talk a bit more about the metro, I presume, but one of the interesting things is that, you know, there has been a bit of a view here that people in Australia won't interchange. You know, they want to just stay on a single mode. I think if you give them a good enough reason, they clearly do.
Yeah.
And if you make it easy. And,
that's right.
We'll come to the decision to come back to Australia shortly, but in your career overall, one of the things we found striking in the research is you've stayed at places quite a long time. Like, if I was to think about other contemporaries that I talk to, contemporaries of yours that I talk to in this sector, they're often quite, you know, it's 3 years here, 3 years there, but you've done like you haven't had many employers.
No, I haven't. And I really like making quite a difference where I am and taking on a big challenge and driving to it. I've been lucky to get those opportunities and to be able to kind of really run with something and leave a particular, you know, legacy in a particular space, and then, you know, find the next interesting thing to do. And it means that you get to really understand, you know, how and what is going on around you, not just sort of, you know, a single transaction. I think, you know, a lot of that is there's an element of luck of just arriving places at the right time and then creating the environment that has allowed, you know, then further things to get done.
Which is a handy segue to the decision to come back to Australia, to New South Wales. And can you just talk us through that time and the decision? And
look, I was having a great time in London from a work perspective, and it did really worry me. We were, you know, running massive investment program, lots of funky kind of, you know, structuring and the like. And when I used to come back to Sydney and there was nothing happening here in the infrastructure space, I used to really worry, what will I do? Yeah, when I come home, there's nothing of the same scale. And it wasn't a sort of a conscious thing that I would move at a particular point in time, but I got approached. I remember a you know, recruitment guy called me up and he's like, "Oh, I'm wondering, I've heard you're a bit of a world expert in PPP restructuring in the railway sector." And I said, "Well, that's very narrow." He said, "Well, have you done any PPP restructuring?" I said, "Yes." He says, "In the railway sector?" I said, "Yes, I have actually." And he goes, "Well, that's a good start." He goes, "How many have you done?" I said, "Oh, I've done quite a few actually." He goes, "Yeah, you're a world expert." He goes, "We haven't found anyone else." And he hadn't realised that I was from Sydney or, you know, from New South Wales. And they were recruiting because they wanted to bring someone into New South Wales Treasury to sort of kickstart the infrastructure program that was likely to happen. It was just back in 2011, just before the government changed to the new coalition government at the time. And so he said, "Oh, is that an Australian accent?" I said, "Yeah, where are you from?" I said, "Oh, yeah."
See, he had the Reliance Rail thing was in mind. Was that?
That's what they were looking for, yes. Yeah, the Waratah train.
Yeah.
And so they wanted someone who could come in and sort that out. I didn't know that at the time, right. But I thought, well, what an interesting opportunity, you know, to go back to Sydney and, you know, to work in Treasury, you know, at a time when there was a fair chance they were going to try and do some different things, and they wanted to sort of, you know, use some international experience. So I thought it'd be a good way to come back and just get to know the market. And so, you know, I was able to sort of get into those restructuring deals, sort out some of the challenges that they had, but the opportunity to come along and to, you know, look at some quite different ways of doing infrastructure and getting out the door quickly, things like Northwest Rail Link, the Sydney Light Rail, North Connects, West Connects. Yeah, there was a lot going at the same time. I think we had 5 or 6 major projects going at once. So that was an incredible learning experience. But also, I think it showed what you could do, and it really repositioned the way that infrastructure was going to be procured, you know, for the next 5 or 6 years. It was a very difficult time, though, because it's still coming off the back of the global financial crisis, and there wasn't, you know, a huge appetite in private markets to invest in things, the toll roads and things at all. Gone through the challenges with the Brisbane and Sydney toll roads going into receivership and the like. So it was a really difficult time. But
And to what extent was the broader strategy of that government visible to you at that time with the the transactions, the asset recycling, therefore the capital that was available, that kind of self-reinforcing cycle, or was that?
I think there was an initial sort of focus on getting the first rate sort of group of transactions done, and I know that certainly the whole concept of the asset recycling was sort of a strong philosophical view that the then treasurer held, but it was the way I think it was then be able to explain to people that if you sell this, you get. We'll invest in that. That actually resonated at the time.
Mm.
Now that's not always going to work, but some of those strategies did evolve, and it was pretty ambitious. Certainly, in the road space, the railway space. If you look at the decision, for example, to build the Northwest Metro, Northwest Rail Link, as it was at the time, and not bring it to the city, there was a lot of people at the time who thought that was a bit, short-sighted, or why would you just build what was essentially a branch line? But actually, it then gave the platform. For what is now our M1 City line, and it was the right order to do it, because if you start with the biggest and most complicated bit, it's not necessarily, when you don't have the capability. I think it was a really clever call.
Mm. My take on it would be that what was important about it is it got something done, and it proved to the market that transactions and things were going to happen, and then that there was a retrofit of the strategic context.
I think that's probably important. Right, and it was a bite-sized, it was still a big project, $7 or $8 billion at the time, but it was something that actually people could get their head around from a size point of view.
But if the problem is if you wait till the perfect plan's in place, the momentum would have
then you may never
be delivered, and then nobody would leave the plan. So
that's exactly right. So I think sometimes it's about sizing off what's enough that you can do so that it makes a difference and works standalone, but then is a real launch pad for when there's an opportunity to do something more. And that's been a big challenge when you're building infrastructure like metros. They're not cheap, and they require they require a lot of commitment, and each one of them is 10 years really from start to finish. So it really does require a very long-term view.
So there was that early range of transactions. I think some of the ports transactions would have been in
that's right
that but the really big stuff that paid for the early parts of WestConnex and some of the metro were the poles and wires transactions. So you were involved in those from a treasury perspective?
No, there was
you spent the money.
I spent the money and then leveraged the money. But no, I wasn't involved in the sale transactions themselves. They were the people sitting next door.
Yeah.
But certainly there was, it was a particular strategy of the government of the day, the desal plant, the ports, the electricity assets, and to really sort of roll them through, in a time when actually there was a very high demand for those kind of assets, both Australia and international funds. But no, I was more looking at the build phase of the, and how to finance.
So you were sat next door salivating about the idea of the money they could produce that you'd be able to deploy.
That's right.
That's brilliant. That's the best side of that table to be on.
Yeah, so it sort of got a lot of traction, I don't think, at the time. People had worked out just how much money would be generated. And then, it was a reasonably attractive time for private capital. People were sort of getting that confidence back post-GFC to start investing in things as well.
Yeah, I also think that... there's the direct transaction proceeds, but I think what people probably failed to realise at the time is it became a self-fulfilling prophecy because that investment generated
growth. Yeah, and I think we were on quite a roll at the time, and there was a very strong level of market interest. There wasn't a lot else happening in the big infrastructure space in Australia at the time.
Yeah.
And certainly the market turned, but... At the time, some of those initial projects came in 30-40% below what sort of people thought they would cost, because the market was just very, very hungry. It's a really interesting example, though, of what happens when government does build a lot of infrastructure. By the time 6-7 years into that rollout, things were coming in at 30-40% more than they'd been forecast, because the market was starting to get saturated from the level of construction activity that was happening at that point, not just Sydney, but Melbourne and Brisbane as well. But it was a bit of a sweet spot at the time to get a lot of those things underway when there was still a fair bit of competitive tension and pressure to actually find things to invest in, find things to build.
And did you find, so like you were mentioning that it was you came back to Sydney at a point where government was quite receptive to innovative financing. And did you find that you were bringing back things that sort of widened the playbook, or was there already a sort of demand for that? And as the sort of appetite has changed over time, how have you had to kind of balance that with the advice you keep giving into?
Look, it's really interesting because Australia has always been very much at the forefront of a lot of these structured infrastructure transactions. Someone tried to explain it to me that it's something to do with the per capita proportion of Australia who are bankers and lawyers, that they just create fancy transactions because you need to. So Australia's already big in that. And even then, you could see a lot of the Australian funds and Macquarie and others operating in the US and the UK. But I did get a lot of transaction experience in what I was doing in the UK in a reasonably sort of specialist environment. Transport for London wasn't part of the same set of controls that existed across most of the UK government, where the UK Treasury had a very strict approach to how and controls how all the PPP and PFI deals were done. And Transport for London was allowed to operate outside of that. So we did do things quite differently. We innovated. And I guess I learned that and brought back a lot of different ways of thinking about it. But they kept evolving. But as I said, I've sort of oscillated a lot between putting these transactions together and then restructuring them. And unfortunately, over time, I think there's been a lot of examples where some of these big structured transactions really probably haven't been fit for purpose and they don't always work. And as the accounting rules and things have changed, they don't provide all of the same benefits that they initially provided. So I think it's not at all costs, and there's some real basic things which I'd certainly seen in the UK, examples of where deals had been put together for the wrong reason. So I was pretty determined in what I was doing here in Sydney that you'd use the private sector where the private sector could genuinely take risk and add value, but not try and push things that they couldn't.
And do you find in that just that it, the more specialist or the more bespoke it becomes, the more that complexity creates risk just for government in terms of its capability to manage it? And
It totally does. And that's not to say you shouldn't do it, but I think I've learned over the years that you can spend so much time at the front end of transactions thinking about all of the different things that might happen and what you would then do if they happen and whose risk that is. And then, of course, what happens is something that you didn't think about or that's something that is completely left field. And so I've kind of gravitated to a view, well, you can't actually sort of prescribe for everything. You need to find ways ultimately to focus more on what the overall partnership is that governments and the private sector are entering into, and not try and prescribe to every detail, because it just won't turn out that way. Things never turn out at this level of complexity how people think they will.
So let's just talk about some of the specific transactions then. I think WestConnex would be the most obvious one to talk about, and then we can come on to some of the Sydney Metro stuff. So WestConnex was a public-public partnership to some extent. So
it certainly was at the start. There was no market up until that point. There'd been plenty of toll road financing deals in Australia, Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, and the previous four that had been done just before the GFC had all failed. So there was no market available.
They'd failed from a
financial point of view. Yes, no, the infrastructure is fantastic. Infrastructure was fantastic, but too heavily structured, too highly leveraged, too highly focused on traffic forecasts that were 10 or 20 years ahead of what was actually going to happen. And so there was no appetite in the private sector to invest in any of those. And the government, was also in a pretty tight financial position at the time. So we did a lot of thinking as to, well, the market will come back. Is there a way to sort of drip feed these things towards the market? And so we decided to set up what was a public-public partnership. So you're setting things up so that when the financing market came back, it could be accessed. And it could be accessed either by borrowing money and putting that into those structures, or by selling the individual roads into sort of more traditional concession structures. So it was a strategy that evolved. The different roads at the time were set up to be separate and sold in tranches or financed in tranches. Things changed along the way, and there was opportunities, and the federal government put some money in as well to accelerate the rollout. They put
debt in, right?
That's right, it was a debt structure.
Yeah. There was no grant or equity from the...
There was there was federal grant and state grant, which effectively was the equity in the structure, and then there was some debt from the federal government, and then private sector debt and private sector equity came in later as well. So it was a structure designed to roll forward to the future.
I just think it's worth reflecting on the complexity of that. So you had effectively balance sheet lending from the federal government to the state government and money from the feds?
Yes, which came in the more traditional grant.
They didn't get paid out on that equity or the...
No, that was grant. The grant. The debt has been repaid.
Right.
And the difference, though, was that the financing was established into ring-fenced vehicles, so it couldn't be moved off for other purposes. It was all very ring-fenced.
You also had value from the returning concessions for M4 and...
That's right. So, and look, it was a decision made at the time that there were future toll road opportunities could be stapled to assist in the financing, and that's... hasn't remained politically sort of attractive over time, but it certainly allowed a real kickstart because a lot of capital could be raised to quickly roll out the development at the time. And that was an effective way to kickstart it. I don't think anyone would really have predicted, though, that the cost of capital fell so rapidly that then long-dated assets like that suddenly became worth a lot more money.
Yeah.
And people could borrow very cheaply. And so that seed capital was put in place, and then it got a lot cheaper for government to keep borrowing, to keep that financing going. But it was a long-run strategy that was put in place. In the end, WestConnex got built a lot faster than was originally intended, and was originally set out over sort of 10 to 12 years. For me at the time, I was much less involved and interested in the actual physical building or construction. It was the financial engineering side of it that, I think sort of probably set up a very different way for government at the time to get those assets built.
And did you do the sale transaction for two parts?
Yeah, so the sale of WestConnex happened in two parts. I didn't run the transaction, but I was involved. I'd gone to Transport for New South Wales at that time. So I was involved, at a senior governance level in the transaction, and a lot of the initial setup for the sale, yes. But some other folks at Treasury led the execution of it.
Yeah. And so then we'll sort of skip over Transport for New South Wales, and then you take the job at Sydney Metro. And so there's a PPP augmentation
sort of
underway or not quite landed?
Yeah, so that's about 4.5 years ago now. I went to Metro in early 2021. And what really excited me about Metro was it is a combination of the things that I was most interested in. I mean, the high-tech railway infrastructure, the city shaping, the property sort of development, the precinct opportunities, but also this combination of government and public and private sort of partnerships all kind of put in together. So it was all of the things that actually I was really interested in. Mm. It was... At the time, the City Metro, the tunnel works were pretty much done, and it was moving to the station building aspect of it.
For the city.
For the city line. And the two West Metros were still sort of at business case or pre-procurement, or the procurement was underway for the airport metro, which, looking back now, a lot's changed since then. And certainly, I absolutely loved the first few months there and getting out on site and seeing all of that incredible work. Unfortunately, in hindsight, it all got a little bit more difficult after that. And it was only 3 months since I went to Metro that the COVID, second round of COVID happened with all the closures and shut down the construction industry, and it completely shot the whole program out. it became increasingly obvious that all of the contracts that had been so beautifully and cleverly put together and intertwined with each other were actually all at large. Right. And we had to then renegotiate every single one midstream while trying to put the program back together. And that is probably the most...
Another PPP restructuring.
Exactly. And I didn't see it coming. Yeah. And in the end, that was probably the most complex commercial contractual sort of recut. But, I absolutely think it was a really amazing example of what governments and the private sector can do, because although there were lots of different contracts, all of the different contractors, we all would meet every month, all in the same room, discussing how we could deliver the project, not the contracts, and piece it all back together. And a lot of that was done based on trust between the private sector and the government. And that trust had been gained by the response in COVID and the very upfront statements that we would not kind of hide behind change in law and the like, that actually there would be a whole of government approach. And in Metro's case, we were big enough, a whole of Metro approach to making sure that the contractors were looked after. And that built a lot of trust. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to renegotiate, reset the programs, put in place incentive schemes to accelerate and, to re-piece the thing back together. Mm-hmm. But it's a classic example of no one had contemplated that one. Mm-hmm. There was certainly no clause and said, and then if there's a pandemic and the construction industry gets shuts down, the following happens.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was very new territory. And very challenging at the time.
So a bit of luck with you being the right person in the right place at the right time there, because in going over to Metro, it was almost widening your realm of responsibilities into kind of the operations, etc. But this sort of dragged you right back into...
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. I have really enjoyed moving away from being financier and sort of restructuring and really learning about that overall delivery. But a lot of it did sort of get back into that world. Interestingly, though, it was less to do with the private financing, because the PPPs in place, we just sort of set them aside in terms of the financing, much more how to restructure the actual commercial agreements, that multi-party commercial agreements that interface and will have to come together to, ultimately in a sequence. And that was the big challenge with COVID, is that projects that relied on contract after contract having to be delivered in a particular sequence, once they were all out of sync, then your whole project's out of sync. Very, very hard to piece back together.
And while this is happening, there's also the Metro West, the partnership structure.
Yeah, so we did put the, and I think having done a lot of different rail PPPs and undone, I was pretty determined for the airport Metro that if government wanted us to do a PPP, that we put one together that made sense and that would survive test of time. So we did that with, at the time, I think there was a fair bit of scepticism as to whether the market could take a PPP of that size. But we did conclude, and I think it was absolutely the right call, that Metro West itself was just too big to put a traditional or even a sort of, more innovative public-private partnership structure in place. Just too big, too many interfaces, too much for any one party to bear. So we did look at a lot of different opportunities, but in the end, the need to keep some flexibility around the scope. We've actually gone with a model that has Sydney Metro sitting much more in the middle as the integrator of all those contracts. And a lot of that was ultimately learning off the back of the way the City Line worked, that no matter how much you can try and pass all those risks to other people, ultimately, at that scale, when you're dealing with a project of the size of the Metro, the government is still sitting in the middle taking the risk. So, maybe it's best to gear the government up to be able to take that risk rather than try and pass it to people who can't really manage the scale of the interfaces. So we did a lot of thinking, but we've ended up doing something that's much more... I guess much simpler.
And so you went with the Metro West one then, where they had that's had a sort of change in direction. You were going down one path and
we were looking at doing a form of public-private partnership, a different kind of form with a lot more shared exposure and shared management within the PPP structure. It was pretty different though, and a lot of people in the industry did a lot of work trying to work out whether you could make something like that work. But in the end, it wasn't really going to be fit for purpose, particularly if there was a need to retain some flexibility around the scope.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I ask the question is that each of the transactions we've spoken about, there's a fairly significant bespoke element to them we mentioned earlier on. Is there a danger that if everything's an experiment, there's no kind of consistency?
Absolutely, Adrian. And I think that's one of the key things. And as perhaps you get a bit older and a bit wiser, you realise that sometimes you've also got to call it that it's worth thinking about new ideas and doing things differently. But if you can't explain them or get enough other people to understand them, then maybe they're too complicated. And so I think, you know, the couple of times where I've been involved in things where we've had to pivot because we tried something new but just wasn't going to work. And I think it's a key learning is don't keep going down a path if ultimately the particular thing you're trying to solve is not going to work at the time. It's probably better, you know, to be able to call that and to see that. So I have a lot of ideas. They don't all work. But I'll certainly have given some of them quite a good go before concluding, no, this isn't going to get up.
I don't want to get into sort of psychology and philosophy, but it's quite interesting to be able to have these sort of unique, innovative ideas, but also to be able to stand back and say, having sort of incubated this, actually, no, it doesn't work. So there's no kind of intellectual sunk capital type.
No, I mean, it's always, there's always, you know, a little bit of, you know, you want to, if you start something, you put a lot of effort in something, you want it to work. But I found over the years, you know, I try and talk to a lot of people in industry, you know, whether they be lawyers or advisors or contractors, or, and test these things constantly. Because often you can sort of get a sense as to, are you pushing something too hard? Will people really understand it?
But is there an element that you're able to do that because of those formative years involved restructuring stuff that
I do think that's been a big part of it, because when you're having to restructure, you know, a big failed PPP or something that hasn't necessarily failed because it was a PPP, but there's some other problem, fundamental problem, like a Sydney Light Rail was a good example where I ended up spending a year working on not much else other than trying to resolve that.
I should say, in the interest of balance, there are lots of PPPs that have not failed.
There's far more have been successful
than haven't.
I just unfortunately seem to end up involved in the ones that have failed. But not all of them. Some of them worked well. But I think that concept of how you have to understand the complexity of what someone else has put together, pull it apart, twist it, and put it back together again with a focus on actually getting the outcome, I think that you learn that in restructuring. And then able to use some of that thinking when putting together things that are new.
So tell me about the echoes of the things in London that have reverberated what you've done in Sydney.
I think the really key thing is that the big end, you know, the London Underground and the problems that it had, it was just too big to try and really pass the risk in the way they tried to pass the risk. And then they designed mechanisms to pretend they'd pass the risk, or to pass the risk for a period of time, and then to have to renegotiate it all. And it just ultimately didn't survive being used in practice.
Right.
And so, but it had been set up so that it couldn't be cancelled, which is always a challenge. And you know, it required some real sort of clever manoeuvring to sort of cancel something that can't be cancelled. Although it is one thing that I have ultimately learnt in the infrastructure space is you can always buy it. It's just about agreeing the price. I think those contracts still exist with it's a public partnership sitting somewhere in London, right? So, but I think the things I enjoyed most in London were, interestingly, a lot smaller. I did a lot of transactions on the Docklands Light Railway out in East London, and they were sort of bite-sized transactions. Could be quite innovative. They didn't sort of, they got done faster. They were pretty sort of under the radar transactions, which allowed a lot more innovation, and putting in place arrangements there that, you know, are quite similar. I think we try and work out how to share risk rather than pass it black and white, you know, structure deals in a way that has enough flexibility, but also is very clear who was doing what But each of those deals then include clauses that, you know, government could buy it back if it needed to. And so you've got all that flex for the things that will happen.
What do you think about that? See, a lot of the discussion around the use of PPs around the, like, the risk transfer or engagement of the private sector and private capital is best used. What do you think about them as a mechanism, a kind of a, like a discipline on government to do what it says it's going to do and to not change things? And like,
yeah, look, that's absolutely key. And one of the reasons I still get quite nervous about any kind of PPP structure is that the best PPPs are ones where you can properly draw a box around it, ring fence what you're trying to do, and transfer that in totality to someone else, and then the government has to keep out of it and not make decisions that actually change what went into that box.
But there's value in contractually forcing them.
And that's right, and that's part of the theory, that actually, if, you know, it forces government to be much more specific up front, but unfortunately, it does then preclude the ability, and some governments change, and people may want to do something different, or there could be an external event, that it's often very hard for that kind of, that real set and forget to hold. And I think some of the biggest challenges in the PPPs I've seen is when government, for whatever reason, has had to make a major variation too far in.
Yeah, but
it's not all the time, right? And maybe it's something to do with the size, because I know, you know, there's been very successful delivery, you know, in Victoria in sort of some of the social infrastructure space where they haven't seemed to have run into the sort of the scale of problems that have occurred in some of the roles.
There's an argument that the fact that that locked box exists makes it it's a high bar to cross to intervene.
Mm.
So I accept there's circumstances change and government might say, well, I don't know what it, Black Swan event happened and therefore we want to change this. But it's a sufficiently high bar where, like, if you don't have it, the temptation to tinker is too high.
Definitely. And for me, one of the real strengths of PPP is that there is this weight of private capital that doesn't go away, that has to be eventually, someone has to pay it back.
Yeah.
And it sometimes forces things back to a solution because that is sitting there and someone has to deal with it.
Mm.
I think that entry point as to sort of, yeah, don't tinker, is really good, but is not always then understood by the other parts of government who then get given the project to manage. And I think that's often a problem, that the procurement, it's all understood.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it gets managed, but it gets managed alongside some managing contractor projects, some other projects, and that sort of need to be hands-off perhaps hasn't always been as well understood.
Well, there's an enduring sense of political risk felt by the government, isn't there? And so you get this propensity to want to step in if elements aren't proving their worth the whole way through.
I think it is really challenging, and yeah, I think I've probably learnt the hard way that you can set all that up with the best of intention, but sometimes other things change that then do require sort of some kind of intervention. And while having all that private capital there is helpful in forcing things to resolution, it's expensive when it doesn't go well.
Mm.
And time is money, and on big projects, time then becomes very expensive.
But there's a designed elegance then to the idea that Sydney Metro is both a developer of the new lines but an owner of the contracts for the operating components, because it has that kind of DNA.
I think that's actually been a really good thing. That, and obviously we work very closely with Transport for New South Wales as part of a broader, more integrated network, but being accountable for development, delivery and operation does put the long-term thinking in the right spot. And yes, we've contracted historically for elements of that with the private sector, operating contracts that are let very early on our Metro West project. We're not doing a PPP, but we're still doing the operating contract early. So you've got that operator there. But ultimately, we are still the long-run owner, the operator, you know, the developer of the project, notwithstanding we're contracting out elements of it. It does provide the opportunity, because we've had a sequence of projects, to have consolidated that expertise.
Yeah.
If you go back to Northwest Rail Link, when it was first done, no one had built a metro in Australia. No one knew how to do it. So it lent itself to a PPP structure that sort of outsourced a lot of that design, integration to consortia of people who could bring in those capabilities. A lot harder for government to do that from a standing start. But we're four lines in now, so it's a lot easier to aggregate that.
Yeah. It's sort of just listening to you talk about government changing course, etc. It is unusual to be talking about innovation in government and showing that there is that appetite to learn, to adapt, to experiment. Do you think you've seen that appetite has changed over time, you know, within government? Like, certainly there's a bit of a discourse around government being very risk averse, but you've not necessarily encountered that. You've really had...
Oh, I've definitely encountered it. No, I have. look, it changes over time. Yeah. And, you know, it government, in my experience, can be subtly different. Mm-hmm. You know, with each minister, with each premier.
Yes.
And it's not so black and white or red and blue that it's one or the other. And the other circumstances change. Mm-hmm. So the financial circumstances, the constraints, you know, in a post-COVID environment, you know, government balance sheets are just not in the same position that they were in pre-COVID, and that has made it a lot more difficult. And you know, other things change as well, the accounting rules and things. You know, some of the benefits of using private structures, you know, are not so much there anymore. So I think it's not always, you know, a free rein to be able to innovate. I think when things work best is when a government's got a very clear idea of what it's trying to achieve, and it sets that out and allows people to think of different ways as to how to get there, and not be too prescriptive. And yeah, that sort of allows different approaches. But it's constantly evolving in the same way as, yeah, the market evolves and transaction sort of, you know, styles evolve. You know, government of whatever persuasion, you know, state and federal, they sort of oscillate back and forward as well.
So as we sit here today, we're some months after the opening of the award-winning City and South West Metro. Where do we stand today? Like, there's the glow, the halo of it having opened. What things are different to what was expected? How's it going?
Yeah, look, it was an extraordinary moment for everyone who's been involved in a Sydney Metro journey. It's 6 years actually this week since the North West Metro opened, and I guess we're up to about 9 months since the City Line opened. What was, I think, most amazing, you know, for a lot of people at the time, is there was a kind of euphoric public reaction that we hadn't quite anticipated. You know, we knew the systems worked and the stations, you know, were quite different to what had been in the network previously.
They're quite different. They really are.
Well, I mean, it goes to your earlier point about the sequencing of the projects, because it wasn't really until the Metro City opened that Sydney felt different.
Yeah, I think
people thought differently about it.
It's very, very different. I mean, the Northwest has been really successful, but you know, a lot of people in Sydney don't get the opportunity to use it. Whereas coming right through the city under the harbour, you know, it's touching a lot more people's lives every day. It is amazing how many people did not know that those large office towers actually were metro stations underneath. And we did got lots of interesting questions at the time. It's like, oh, but how did you do this? We didn't know this was being built. Which is a bit odd when you spent the last 4 or 5 years of your life.
5 years ago, if you, like we were, trying to find office space in Sydney, you knew.
Yeah.
Because it's about five blocks of, like city blocks knocked out.
Yeah. So, look, I think what's been good is obviously the railway itself has worked incredibly well.
Yeah.
The performance, you know, day in, day out, it's been 99.X%. There's been a few incidents, and yeah, that's been a real learning experience for us as well, is that when you don't have very many incidents, the pressure is so much on.
But they've been well managed, it's not.
Look, I think we've had three incidents in the city that have had sort of, yeah, they've got some attention. You know, we can learn from every one of them, and you know, I think the fascinating thing to see is that it's a very different technology to other railways in Australia. We can recover from incidents a lot faster and get the trains moving back. There's a lot more flexibility in the operating patterns that the trains can be switched to at very short notice. And those things actually limit the impact of the incident. We're still seeing patronage grow, which is great. And I think the M1 City Line is now the busiest rail line in Australia.
Is it beyond expectation? Like, so where's it sort of at relative to what you thought it would get to?
Yeah, it is a bit above expectation in the pre-opening, but interestingly, if you track right back to when the project was originally planned, it hasn't hit those patronage levels because the overall public transport patronage has sort of stubbornly only recovered to about 80-85% of pre-COVID levels, and with changes in work patterns and the like. So we're very, very pleased with the number of people who are on it.
Surprisingly stubborn, isn't it?
It is surprisingly stubborn. There has definitely been a mode shift within public transport. There's definitely been a mode shift from outside of public transport onto the metro. And I think what's been really most interesting is there's definitely been a significant uptick in interchanging between modes. Small things like rerouting local buses to go to the new metro stations has been hugely popular.
Wow.
And people have changed their habits. And that's been really exciting.
Mm. So what are some of the unexpected behaviours or travel patterns? I mean, there's the macro numbers of how many people, but are people doing things different to what
you anticipated? Yeah, there are. There's a couple of examples. I mean, we knew that a lot of people would change at Chatswood, who were coming down the North Shore line because they could get to the city faster. And that's happening. It's happening in very high numbers. But there are people who come down from the Central Coast in Newcastle who change to the metro at Epping to come across to North Sydney in the city, who would have previously taken the train around to Central. And we hadn't expected that volume. And a lot, they're doing that because it's quicker. And even though they might not get a seat, it's a faster journey and a more frequent journey. We've also seen a change in pattern, sort of particularly between the city and North Sydney. You know, people in the city are going to North Sydney for lunch and coming back, or people in North Sydney are taking the metro under the harbour to Barangaroo to go for a run around the park and then going back to the office. So you can see that sort of stuff happening, which we hadn't predicted.
Much more lifestyle-y thing.
It is, and that's generating journeys. I think it's going to be really interesting next year when we open the Bankstown line section into Sydenham, and that will create a whole range of much faster journeys for people along that line, because once you get to Sydenham, then it is a lot faster to the city, particularly to North Sydney, or for people, you know, going out to Macquarie Park or something like that. So that will be the next big boost.
And that's more economic as well, because you get like better job matching.
Yeah, and it really connects different centres that are actually quite hard to get to at the moment by public transport. Yeah. So I think, we're looking forward to that, and that will be a big leap.
And Bankstown is getting really exciting, like just even in anticipation of that.
I think it's going to be pretty incredible. And the opening up of the town centre there between what's now the Sydney Trains and the metro station, it's looking great. Yeah.
Now, I took one of the bus services out there along the rail corridor to Lakemba Nights recently, and it just, even the bus service was really good. Like, it just was very efficient.
And people have been very patient. It is really difficult to do those kind of conversions. People have been very patient. It is quite difficult work that we're doing, but
It was quite crowded, but it was.
But it's coming along, and I think it's going to be quite a real win for customers when that opens.
Mm. So just fast forwarding, there's four lines now, in operations and through to planning. Fast forward 50, 100 years, what does it look like?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I get asked a lot about which line is next and the like. The way I see it is that there's always going to be multiple competing pressures on government budgets for infrastructure, for housing, for whatever. What I think is really important is that we show the benefit of what the metro can do in terms of increasing the ability for people to move around, generating trips, supporting housing, creating opportunities for new precincts. We've got a big program out to 2032 with the Southwest Metro, the new Airport Metro, Metro West. And then there's lots of different options. All the lines are designed to be extended at either end. And progressively, you know, I think it is really important that we continue to work out, well, where would the corridors be if they're on the surface? Where would they come? Even if, you know, government of the day will potentially look at them in different orders, different priorities, but the key thing is to sort of really develop out a whole body of opportunity for what the metro network could look.
So you'd like to see it like turn into almost a program where the debate is about the order.
Look, if certainly if you look around the world, where metro systems have grown progressively, you know, and very incrementally, it is very much on that program basis. And so what we are looking at, and you know, it's a difficult time at the moment in terms of you know, budget challenges, but in order to help with that, we also need to look at how can we develop ways to develop the metro in smaller incremental bite-sized pieces. You know, maybe it's a few stations at a time, not sort of 10 stations at a time. How can we do that commercially without, you know, sort of making it all too complicated to then be able to deliver? But also, how can we provide the same level of high quality, high frequency, high reliability railway that people want to and are attracted to, but do it more cheaply? And so that takes you into sort of considerations around modularization, you know, more modern methods of manufacturing, you know, what can be done in a prefabricated way, you know, how can we make these things easier to build, cheaper to build, without compromising, you know, the standard of the actual metro railway product itself. And certainly, you know, I've had the opportunity to see a bunch of different metro systems around the world, not all of them, there's lots of different versions, but you know, I've been really impressed with that sort of incremental approach that's applied, particularly in places like Singapore and Hong Kong, where there is a program, and yes, you can change the order, but there's a real well-considered pathway. So, you know, if I can help get people to that, then, you know, when funds are available in the future, then they, you know, you can sort of buy down the next tranche. But there is something to be said for, you know, at least trying to have some kind of ongoing pipeline to retain the knowledge, both within the government but also within industry. But it is challenging at the moment, and they're very expensive to build.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 50-year outlook, not a 5-year one.
So. I think that's right. Yeah. And these assets, some of them are built, you know, 50 to 100 years in mind. So I just think, you know, the metro itself is also not ever going to be the sole part of the transport network. You're going to have different, you're going to have light rail, you've got the existing heavy rail network, you've got all the other connections, and they all need to kind of work seamlessly together, and they're not really designed to sort of replace each other. But certainly what we have seen with the Metro City Line is that the ability now between ourselves and Sydney Trains to flex when the other one has, like, you know, a maintenance closure or there's an operating incident, yeah, the two lines are working quite well in parallel, and we are, you know, that's, we can increase frequencies if there is, you know, sort of major works being done on Sydney Trains, but also, you know, if there is, and you know, luckily there haven't been too many, but when there are instances on Metro, people still got another option. So I think they've got to work in parallel with each other.
And just on that global comparison, this isn't really a question, it's more of a statement, but it is legitimately world class. Like the stations in particular in the CBD, they are stunning pieces of architecture. I can see where we spend the money. But it does, it makes Sydney feel a bit more like a grown-up global city.
And I know people have different views around the stations and, you know, sort of the architecture, but they were deliberate decisions that were made at the time to make them statements. Again, I think there's a balance to be found.
So I think they're worthy decisions for the, like, the marquee stations.
I think for the flagship stations, and that, I think that's the other key thing, right? And we're looking for Metro West, you know, sort of, maybe there's a distinction between the big flagship stations and some of the suburban stations that perhaps don't need, you know, all of that. And that's why I say I think there's ways to build them cheaper and to also, you know, to learn so that we don't have to design from scratch each time. And they are quite bespoke. And there's certainly benefits in having the back of house stuff that you don't see a lot more standardized so that it can be built out without as much design and redesign and the like. So there's definitely learnings, but yeah, certainly it has been amazing. We've attracted a lot of attention around the metro world, and you know, it's been it's been great to see that there are people who now come to Sydney to look at our metro and learn rather than us having to go on trips to learn about how other people do things.
Yeah. We'll call this episode Peter Regan Does Bespoke Stuff. We've come to the end of the time, but we always ask all of our guests the same final question, which is, what's your favourite sort of infrastructure and why?
Well, my favourite sort of infrastructure, well, certainly I would go struggle to go past the metro.
They're not a specific project. I mean, you can choose a specific one. Come on.
But I know, I do really like that combination, as I said before, of high technology railway that is not just connecting places but creating places. I think the place element is something I haven't talked too much about today, but I really love what that can do. Mm. And creating integrated precincts around infrastructure, I think, is pretty exciting.
How would your former WestConnex colleagues feel about you saying your favourite type of infrastructure is the other mode?
Look, I think the WestConnex infrastructure is impressive and was city shaping in its own way. Hmm. But for me, I think railways and what they can bring, particularly in that context, in the placemaking context, is probably more of the future. And for me, I've worked more in public transport infrastructure than not. For me, at the time, my interest in sort of some of the toll roads was more in the financial structure than the delivery. But my career has sort of moved across into delivery. But no, I think high capacity, attractive railways will make a much bigger difference in the long run, and really allow Sydney to grow and develop around those corridors. That's not to say, though, that completing those key sort of motorway connections weren't important. It was important. Mm. But the real growth will come, I think, in sort of,
But it's the confluence of the mode, the technology. So is it metros specifically?
Oh, no, it doesn't. Not just metro. See, I mean, high-speed rail could do the same thing. And
then we'll really see where the money is.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, it might have to be done in an incremental basis. Maybe not three stations at a time, maybe one station at a time.
Yeah.
But no, I just think that the long-term planning, and I think it's great that we're starting to see some of it more in Australia, but I look at, I've always been amazed, sort of, in Japan and in Singapore, they're planning so far in advance and planning whole new cities around where they'll put the rail infrastructure, and it's so carefully considered and then it's executed from a long way out. And I'd like to think that we should be more ambitious in that.
What's their planning time frame? Like, how far out do they go with that?
40 years. And I think we have plans that are 40 50 years, but they're not to that same level of certainty and ambition that they're
wanting. But Sydney Metro can be the pathfinder for that in Australia. Like, you move to that more program sort of strategic.
Look, I think so. And I think the debate over the last couple of years has been really positive around the role that metros and other high capacity railways can play in housing as well.
Mm.
And really, enabling a focus. But housing of itself doesn't work. It has to be in a context of a good mixed use sort of precinct, but trying to concentrate that development around where you're already investing in infrastructure makes a lot of sense, and I think more of that for the future would be a good thing as well.
It does, and it's a great note to finish on. So Peter, thank you very much for
joining
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.